This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Anybody who tells you that sports and politics aren't linked has never studied ancient Rome. After all, what were the gladiatorial games if not a distraction to keep idle, unemployed Romans from rising up against their leaders? We're going to start today's show with a more recent tale of politics and sport, and to help make our point, we're not going to start this one at a sporting event. We're going to start with an election, the election of a new pope. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
On March 19, 2013, as a rainy day turned to dusk, tens of thousands of people huddled together under multicolored umbrellas on St. Peter's Square at the Vatican. Then, just after 7 p.m., white smoke appeared through the chimney of the Sistine Chapel. Lino Rulli and Father Dave Dwyer had the call from the Vatican for the Catholic Channel.
You can actually see that the curtain is about to be pulled back. The window is about to be opened. And let's take a listen to the name of the next pope.
4,000 miles away, Randy Kaplan, a Jew from Long Island, was in his office in New York. He's a lobbyist, watching CNN with his boss and a good friend. Randy's always paying attention when a new head of state is announced.
To me, that's my Kentucky Derby, or that's my Super Bowl, absolutely.
For 20 years, Randy has been trying to do something that sounds pretty simple. He wants to get a baseball signed by the Pope. And for 20 years, he failed.
Very, very hard to infiltrate that inner circle. I tried every mechanism which I know, and I don't take no for an answer, so it's very difficult for me to come to terms with it's not going to happen.
But this time, Randy wasn't taking any chances. Knowing that he was unlikely to get a sitting pope to sign a baseball, he instead started requesting signed balls from the cardinals most likely to become the next pope, and...
Before the smoke was rising from the chimney at the Vatican, I probably had about 20 of the cardinals out of about 25 or 30 who had a realistic chance.
Cardinal Bergoglio.
The faces of the two Catholic Channel announcers said it all. They weren't expecting this. No one was.
I believe it's fair to say the world is stunned.
This is a stunner. This is a stunner.
Except Randy Kaplan had sent Cardinal Bergoglio, now named Pope Francis, a baseball to be signed. But it had been returned to sender. So Randy still didn't have a baseball signed by the Pope, but he wasn't about to give up. With help from a friend who happened to be a cardinal, he sent a couple more baseballs to the Pope's personal secretary, but he wasn't optimistic.
Getting the actual Pope to sign as Pope, that's hitting the jackpot for autograph collectors.
Randy Kaplan's not just any autograph collector. His quest is to collect baseballs signed by all of the heads of state and world leaders. So how did a guy from Long Island dream up that idea? Growing up in the 70s, Randy collected the kinds of things kids were collecting back then. Wacky package stickers, baseball cards.
Aurora Monster model kits, the glow-in-the-dark kits.
I have no idea what that is.
Universal Monsters, licensed with Aurora Plastics Company in Hempstead, New York, back in the 60s and 70s. And they were the hottest thing since sliced bread for kids.
When Randy was in high school, he snuck backstage at rock concerts, hoping to catch a glimpse of one of his idols. And because he was close to Manhattan, Randy met lots and lots of famous people.
I asked for a couple of autographs here and there throughout, but nothing crazy.
In April of 1993, things started to get decidedly crazier. Randy was on a business trip to Houston, and he decided to go to an Astros game. The woman sitting next to him mentioned that former President George Herbert Walker Bush and his wife Barbara came to games whenever they were in town.
He was just out of office a couple of months, and I've always been a huge admirer of his. And I did not think that they would be coming on that particular night because there was a failed assassination attempt on the former president just a couple of days prior in Kuwait. But lo and behold, sure enough, after the second inning begins, here comes George and Barbara Bush, and they sit down literally a row in front of me. So I'm like, this is amazing. Because as a kid in my teens and in my 20s, I had met everybody you could imagine. The rock stars, as I mentioned, the sports stars. I was never moved so much as when I met a president. I had him sign my scorecard, and I remember bouncing off the walls.
A couple of weeks later, Randy was visiting the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, and he saw a collection of baseballs. They had all been first pitches thrown by sitting presidents.
And I said to myself, oh my God, what an amazing idea it would be to have presidents and world leaders sign baseballs and start a collection and share it with the world.
Randy thought about the idea for 3 years. He wasn't quite sure where to begin. Then in 1996, he was working as the government affairs director for a large trade association, and then President Bill Clinton came to give a speech. Randy arrived 3 hours early. Secret Service agents were still doing their sweep. He got a seat near the front. As soon as the talk was over, he hopped into the receiving line.
And I accomplished my goal. I got my baseball signed by Bill Clinton. It was wonderful. It was a great way to start.
Tell me the story of how you got the Gorbachev ball.
Oh, God, this is a wonderful story.
It was 1996, 5 years after the Soviet Union dissolved. Gorbachev had written a memoir and scheduled 2 book tour stops in the United States.
So I knew I had to get to the book signing early. I also knew I needed a trick up my sleeve because security was going to be extremely tight.
Luckily, Randy's landlord was Russian. Randy asked him to write out a Russian phrase, phonetically, on the back of a business card. And he brought the card with him to the book signing.
And I practiced all morning. As I approached the table, Mr. Gorbachev smiled. And as he's signing the book, I pulled the baseball out. Security jumped on my arms to take the baseball away and push me away.
Through all the commotion, Randy kept speaking directly to the former Soviet leader.
It started off something along the lines of Butle Lebezhnev. I don't remember the rest, but I do remember the concept was, Mr. Gorbachev, it's a pleasure to meet you. Would you be kind enough to sign my baseball and take a photograph with me? President Gorbachev stood up, pushed the security guard out of the way, retrieved the baseball from my hand, signed it, stood up and bowed to me and sat down. I was so proud of that.
Randy says getting Gorbachev to sign one of his baseballs so early in his quest really gave him the momentum to keep going. You're not partisan with this at all, are you?
Absolutely not. Republican, Democrat, communist, independent, it doesn't matter. I don't even think about politics when I pursue my collection. My mantra and my motto is diplomacy through baseball.
Randy hopes one day his collection will be displayed at the headquarters of the UN. And he wants people who see it to understand that we may have disagreements, but that we're all here on the same planet. And countries that feel like they're on the other side of the world, well, they're really not far away at all.
And this way we can get the world to come together and hopefully be a better place.
We have different ideology, but we share the same biology, Randy said. Then he laughed and admitted that he stole that phrase from a Sting song. But make no mistake, Randy Kaplan cares deeply about who wins major elections in the U.S. and around the world.
The average person walking down the street, they're worried if the Yankees won or the Mets won. They're not worried about who the new French president's going to be.
Don't worry. Before votes were even cast, Randy had already collected baseballs signed by both Emmanuel Macron and runner-up Marine Le Pen. Randy says he spends 20 to 30 hours a week researching world leaders and prospective world leaders. That's how he got signed baseballs from Barack Obama and Donald Trump long before either had announced their candidacy for president. And he never goes anywhere without a bag filled with half a dozen baseballs and some pens. He says you never know who you're going to run into.
I sat next to Henry Kissinger on a plane one day by sheer chance, coming home on the shuttle 20 years ago. My wife and I were having dinner one night. We ran into a couple of foreign leaders, the former president of Benin, Matthew Caracau, who's now deceased.
Okay, so it's quite possible that I've sat in a restaurant with the former president of an African country I can't even point out on a map. But Randy's not like me. He's researched all the world leaders. There's no country too small or too far flung. But while Randy's familiar with all the world's leaders aren't familiar with America's national pastime. So when Randy handed Matthew Caracow that baseball,
I had to point to it and show him what to do, where to sign it.
As news of Randy's collection has spread, more and more people have been offering to help. He now has 350 baseballs signed by world leaders, plus about 1,000 more signed by prospective future world leaders. He keeps them at a secured storage facility and only gets to see his collection when a museum puts it on display. Despite all his successes, Randy was still waiting for his Holy Grail, a baseball signed by the Pope. And then one day, about 2 months ago,
the mail comes. I didn't even have to open it. I knew the ball was signed. I had this unbelievable feeling inside. I opened it up. The ball is beautifully signed, Francisco. I am still bouncing off the walls and beaming about this one. To think that, here's how I look at this. The Pope held the baseball in his hand. He knows about my collection. He knows all the other people who've signed it. That's very meaningful to me.
It's probably a stretch to suggest that the Pope signed Randy's baseball because he likes the idea of bringing the world together through baseballs signed by world leaders. Then again, that seems like just the kind of message Pope Francis would support. And besides, Randy Kaplan says, a baseball signed by the Pope is one step closer to having them all.
The Pope, let's face it, one of the toughest and most desirable signatures on the planet. Right up there with the Chinese leader and Vladimir Putin, both of which I would love to have. If anybody's listening and they have a relationship with either Vladimir Putin or the current Chinese leaders, please do get in touch with me.
That's Randy Kaplan speaking with Only a Game's Karen Given. And if you'd like to get in touch with Randy, maybe you have Mr. Putin's private phone number. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. In the late 40s, there was a rumor that had the owner of the Red Sox sending Ted Williams to New York for Joe DiMaggio.
Yawkey woke up the next morning with a raging headache.
I'm sure that there was a lot of scotch involved in this.
DiMaggio was Mr. Yankee and Williams was Mr. Red Sox.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. Disney Mom and Kid left the following review of Only a Game on iTunes. I am a suburban mom of a certain age, and I have never been athletic, but I do truly love three things about sports: baseball, the Olympics, and Only a Game. I look forward to the new episode every week. Thanks, Only a Game. Thank you, Disney Mom and Kid. Your review will help other listeners find our show, and who knows, maybe it will also inspire your fellow listeners to visit iTunes and leave a review of their own. That'd be swell. I'm Bill Littlefield. Wimbledon carries on this weekend. Whether it keeps calm is to be determined. Anyway, that's where we're going to start on this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know. Joining me are WBUR Shira Springer and Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Thank you.
Shira, your serve.
Thank you. This week at Wimbledon, former number one ranked tennis player Victoria Azarenka complained about scheduling. Here's the deal. She's the mother of a six-month-old little boy, and she was kept waiting to figure out whether or not she was going to play on Monday. This led to further complaints and criticisms about sexist scheduling at Wimbledon. Men get more matches on the favored show courts. And for me, this is going to be the next battleground, I think, in women's sports. So we've seen this fight over pay equity. I think we're going to see a fight, or at least more awareness of the lack of equity when it comes to when they play, where they play, the number of primetime TV slots. Women are going to push for more equality in this arena. We're already seeing it, actually, with the 2024 Olympic bid for LA. They have made gender equity a priority. And basically, they're saying, we're going to pay attention to where women are playing. No longer are they going to be put in secondary arenas that are not on prime Olympic real estate.
I think that Azarenka, just by raising the issue in two ways, advances her cause. One is the obvious. Oh, I hadn't known about that beforehand, thinking about it. Yeah. But then two, I didn't know that Victoria Azarenka is a mom. And then you go online, you see pics of the baby, and you have something else to root for. And oh, my God, when that happens with Serena, then there will be a clamor to put her on all the most watched courts.
Regarding the Olympics, I'm not really sure that equality is the goal of the Olympics. I think the goal of the Olympics is corporate profit and the self-aggrandizement of the IOC. But if they can also manage to pursue equality, good on them, I guess.
Well, I'll agree with you. Yes, the Olympics are largely about corporate greed and making money. But I do think there is a problem, and it's sort of, I experienced it when I was covering the Olympics, you know, in Sochi. The women's hockey tournament was largely staged in a much smaller arena, while the men played most of their games in this showcase arena right next door. And what's the message you're sending there? Well, the message is that you don't value women's hockey as much as you value men's hockey.
So, interestingly, that's the message that Boston University also sends. Interesting.
Yeah, so but I think that if they can make a stand here and create optics that say we value women's sports as much as men's sports, and they should, because they're equally worth watching.
One last thing. Let's just be fair to the Olympics. They're also about propping up tin pot dictators. So let's put that out there.
So many things on the Olympic agenda you have to consider these days.
It's complicated. Yeah. I want to stick with the theme of gender in sports. There was a terrific article. Peter Keating wrote it for ESPN, the magazine. The title is, Why Does It Seem Like Nobody Cares About Female Concussions? And his contention is that the group, the most highly publicized group that worries about concussions, the Concussion in Sport group, has kind of left women out of the study. The NCAA appears to be beginning to address the discrepancy, but only beginning. Women are, by all accounts, first of all, more prone to suffer concussions when they play the same sports as men. And also, they recover more slowly. The damage is often worse, and more often their careers are ended by these injuries. I really hope those involved with a Concussion in Sport group read this article and that other people read it, and that it brings about a change that is not only necessary but long overdue.
Well, I know the answer to the question, and it's maybe, well, there is sexism baked into it, but, you know, concussions became this gripping national issue because it was centered on our number one sport, which is football, which very few women play overall. But then in soccer, which is played more by women, women have more concussions. We have to start thinking about it. Who are our guardians? The NCAA, which has this student athlete designation so they won't have to pay long-term health care. I think that the answer needs to be people like us, journalists, amplifying people like Keating, another journalist, and putting it on the agenda for these organizations.
I agree with you, Mike. I think the NFL was the poster game, so to speak. Also, because the NFL has been around so long and because women playing professional sports and women playing sports over a long period of time where they could sustain multiple concussions is something that's relatively new, you don't have sort of the study group of older female athletes. It's not like there are a lot of 65, 70, 75-year-old former female pro athletes where you can study and see if they have CTE.
All right, Mike, I gather you're going to talk about baseball and economic theory.
Yeah, I'll talk about baseball first, and then I'll bring in the theory. All-star game. Now it doesn't count. Before, it counted for home field advantage. Whichever league won the all-star game,
ridiculous.
They got home field advantage in the World Series. Mm-hmm. And this affected play, I'd say not at all, maybe ever so slightly. It really seemed like an exhibition. Let's introduce the principal agent theory. So what principal agent theory says is sometimes the principal, say the owner of a business, wants a certain course of action, but the agent, the person who's in charge of executing that, has a different set of incentives. So a classic example is the movie theater owner wants just a certain amount of popcorn, but the guy giving the popcorn out would rather give more popcorn than less, so the customers like him. Here you have the managers. They're the agents of Major League Baseball's wishes, which is to have a competitive All-Star game. But the managers have an entirely different set of incentives. What they want to do is get everyone in the game. They just want to manage things in the least volatile way possible. So we have an economic or political science theory explaining why the All-Star game never really got as contentious as Bud Selig would have wanted it to be.
Shira, I don't know how much of this you've followed or how much economics you studied.
Mike's a very good professor.
By all means, we welcome your comment.
Well, first of all, you know, the whole thing started in 2002 with basically an overreaction to a tie game. You know, that's how we got to this rule change to award home field during the World Series to the winner of the All-Star game. And, you know, this being baseball, not unlike the NCAA and international sports, slow to change. Honestly, though, I'm surprised it took them so long to figure out, you know what? It should go to the team, you know, the pennant-winning team with the better regular season record. I mean, that's the obvious team to have home field advantage in the World Series.
I have to make a confession here. I haven't paid any attention to the All-Star game since Willie Mays was last an All-Star.
So what made you pay attention then, though? Is it just
Willie Mays made me pay attention then?
So we need better stars? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we need better stars. And for me, the All-Star break is a break from baseball. But, Mike, I'm going to ask you to wrap this up.
I'll wrap up with a fun Willie Mays All-Star fact.
Excellent.
Willie Mays played for 22 seasons and was an All-Star for 24 of them.
That's right, because there were 2 years where they had two All-Star games. They were running out of money.
That's right.
They were running out of money and thought we better spike the coffers with an additional All-Star game.
Okay, that's not the solution I'm looking for. Not two games in 1 year.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist, and WBUR Shira Springer, who also contributes to the Boston Globe. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're swinging at the whistling line, drive to left center field. It's a
Was ever a ball player more pure New York Yankee, more representative of the excellence and the dignity and, yeah, the cool embodied by the Yankees at their most Yankee than Joe DiMaggio?
DiMaggio makes it with a slide and is safe for a double.
He played his entire career in pinstripes. During 5 of his first 6 seasons, he led the Yankees to championships. He was a terrific all-round ball player, the best of his time. And you don't have to take my word for it.
There's no question in my mind. I played against Joe DiMaggio a lot of my career.
That's Ted Williams from an interview recorded in 1975 by former broadcaster and reporter Joel Alderman. It's been sitting on a shelf gathering dust ever since. Williams was effusive in his praise of the Yankee Clipper.
I was terribly impressed with DiMaggio, and I thought that he was the best player, all-around player for sure. There's a lot of great all-around players, too, but I don't think they could quite match to his hitting. DiMaggio was a super hitter. Gee whiz, I mean a super hitter.
High praise from the fellow who'd announced at the beginning of his own career that he wanted to be recognized as the greatest hitter ever.
Here's the pitch. Williams swings, and there's a long drive to deep right. That ball is gone.
And maybe he was. He was certainly as much the face of the Boston Red Sox, for which he played his entire career, as DiMaggio was the face of the Yankees. How could it have been otherwise? Can anybody who was a baseball fan in those days imagine a baseball world so bizarro that Williams would be playing for the Yankees and DiMaggio patrolling center field in Fenway Park? Impossible, right?
Before the 1947 season, allegedly, Tom Yawkey was meeting with a Yankee official.
Baseball historian Glenn Stout has written extensively about both the Yankees and the Red Sox, the latter team owned for many years by Tom Yawkey. He recalled for us a dinner meeting between Yawkey and Yankees owner Dan Topping at Toot Shores Restaurant in New York, a popular destination for, among others, Joe DiMaggio.
Others, it says it was during spring training. And that's where the story gets murky, because none of this was reported at the time.
Or perhaps not much reported. But over 2 decades later, the meeting did provide a column for celebrated New York Times sports columnist Dave Anderson, now retired. Anderson began following New York sports in the 40s, but he says he was not the first of his fraternity to write about the meeting, which he does recall.
And this was back, I believe, in 1948. It could have been 47. It could have been 49. Dan Topping, who was the Yankees owner, and Tom Yawkey had been sitting together or having dinner together at the old Toots Shores restaurant in Midtown Manhattan. And in the course of perhaps a few drinks, they agreed to trade Joe DiMaggio to the Red Sox for Ted Williams, who would come to the Yankees.
This was not perhaps as big a deal as a straight-up trade of Khrushchev for Kennedy might have been in 1960, but it was bigger than any other trade in baseball would have been. Each man meant everything to his team, but DiMaggio, quiet, reserved, elegant, beloved by the writers, was New York all the way. Williams was known to spit rather than tip his cap to his fans, and he regarded a lot of the Boston press as treacherous at best. They weren't exactly interchangeable, these two. Don't you have to wonder how the subject of a trade even came up?
I'm sure that there was a lot of scotch involved in this trade.
Okay, but according to Glenn Stout, there was perhaps some imagination involved, too.
You might be able to make the argument that if you're the Red Sox manager, maybe you do want Joe DiMaggio. DiMaggio gets to aim at the left field wall. Maybe he hits a little better in Fenway than he did in Yankee Stadium. And, you know, he gets to play with his brother.
Makes a certain kind of sense, right? Joe joins his brother Dom in the Boston outfield. The park is made for a right-handed line drive hitter. Maybe Joe DiMaggio would have led the Red Sox to at least a couple of those many pennants the Yankees won. Meanwhile, in the Bronx, Williams could aim at that short porch in right field. In another interview Joel Alderman recorded with Williams well after the slugger had retired, Williams thought about that.
Well, I think it's easy to say that, and it could have very well be true. But I know from my experience that I got balls to hit in Boston because of the long right field fence from the very pitchers that I might have hit at in Yankee Stadium that I would have never got a chance to hit that same pitch in Yankee Stadium. Because the fence being long, they said, well, we've got to make him hit here.
So Ted Williams was willing to consider what it would have been like if Yankee Stadium had been his home park. Not many hitters would have approached that hypothetical situation as thoughtfully. And that wasn't the only quality the Yankees would have found attractive in the late 40s. Williams was younger than his Yankee counterpart.
If you were thinking long term, somebody who's going to be in the lineup for the next 10 years, well, that was Ted Williams. It wasn't Joe DiMaggio.
The trade was not to be. One version of the story has it that Tom Yawkey woke up the morning after making the trade with a headache and a sick feeling in the pit of his stomach. The former from all that scotch, the latter the result of the realization that he'd traded his franchise player for a fellow who might not have many years of excellence left. But according to Joel Alderman, who interviewed both Williams and Joe DiMaggio, the truth was more complicated and Tom Yawkey less hungover.
He wanted the Yankees to throw in another ball player. And that ball player was a rookie left fielder by the name of Larry Yogi Berra. And that was the end of that discussion. It turned out that Yogi was the deal breaker.
Maybe, and maybe not. Nobody could have guessed that in the next decade, Berra would be the league's most valuable player three times. The Yankees hadn't yet asked him to try catching. So the Williams-DiMaggio trade failed to happen for reasons that may have had nothing to do with Yogi Berra. But while Joel Alderman contends that neither side was ever serious about the exchange, at least in the cold light of morning, Glenn Stout says there had been some talk of trading Williams even before DiMaggio's name had come up.
At the end of the 1946 season, just before the World Series, front page news in all the Boston papers that there were rumors that Ted Williams was going to be traded. So Ted played the entire 1946 World Series with this enormous cloud over his head. Am I going to be traded? At that time period, who else would you have traded Ted Williams for? Who else would you have traded Joe DiMaggio for?
Hypothetical questions, rumors, stories where the dates, times, and locations are up for grabs. It's all the stuff of dreams, I guess. Or maybe nightmares.
Because here's where it's all fraught with peril. If Ted would have went to New York and hit 250, if Joe would have went to Boston and the Red Sox finished fourth, then somebody is going to have to own that, you know, because, you know, we all kind of look at it as it might have been a great thing, but it also could have been a bad thing.
Actually, tantalizing as the trade story or stories might be, even 70-odd years after the fact or fiction, there is one thing about which our three baseball historians agree.
It's hard to see Ted in pinstripes. It's hard to see DiMaggio wearing a B on his cap.
Ted Williams belonged in Boston, and Joe DiMaggio belonged in New York.
DiMaggio was Mr. Yankee, and Williams was Mr. Red Sox. And it stayed that way, fortunately.
And perhaps that's where the story should be left, except for a postscript that says something about the game itself. In every sport, players change teams. In every sport, fans gobble up rumors and talk about what they'd do if they were granted the mighty power of a general manager. And as retired columnist Dave Anderson sees it, the passage of time means nothing to those who deal in such might-have-beens.
The important thing really is that we're still talking about them. How many players who played in the 40s do we talk about now?
Not many, I guess, and many fewer still in any sport but baseball, where the myriad numbers players generate and the quirks of the parks in which they play make idle speculation about who would have done what if they'd traded jerseys such fun. As a Russian immigrant during the Cold War, the NBA's Tom Mascheri was bullied on the school playground until one day he was playing kickball.
And I kicked the ball so damn far, all of a sudden I realized everything had changed. And it had changed because I had done something that they respected.
That's just ahead. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, competitive speed cubing, as in Rubik's racing. But now, on to my discussion of the week in sports with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. I thought that was like speed math, cubing. And
there'll be no math on my watch.
Excellent.
Thank you.
It's part of the reason I've stayed so long.
It's the NBA offseason, which means that everybody's paying attention to free agents signing huge contracts to play in new destinations. Any particular changes catch your eye?
Well, obviously, the Celtics finally made a large free agent acquisition with prying Gordon Hayward loose from Utah, much to the consternation of jersey-burning Utah fans.
Yeah, boy, you got through my first two questions with your answer. They're burning jerseys in
Utah.
Yeah,
and the Celtics also traded Avery Bradley, which I think they're going to regret because he was their best on-the-ball defender. Vince Carter going to the Sacramento Kings is just, you know, he might as well play on the moon because nobody knows what Sacramento's doing. But I was kind of interested in Rudy Gay getting $17 million out of the Spurs because that's proven to be this fountain of youth for NBA players on the back nine, as they say.
On Tuesday, Yankee slugger Aaron Judge damaged Yankee Stadium with
a home run
blast. He broke the stadium. He did. On Wednesday, he tied Jolton Joe's rookie home run mark before the All-Star break. He now has half a season to add to that record. Does this answer the musical question, where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio?
Yeah, you've left the record books. I love stories about baseball players like breaking stuff with their, you know, I love the red
seat. Roy Hobbs.
The red seat in Fenway Park and the light standard that Reggie Jackson hit in Tiger Stadium in the All-Star game and the end of the movie The Natural.
There it is.
I like baseball players who break things.
The Tour de France is underway, and it took less than one day for the first disqualification. Slovak rider Peter Sagan elbowed Brit Mark Cavendish off his bike in the first stage, and for that reason, the elbower will miss the rest of the tour. But apparently he was not on drugs at the time
happened,
so there's that to celebrate.
But he broke the guy's shoulder.
Yeah, he did. Well,
I mean, Aaron Judge is just breaking stadiums. These guys are, you know, although I'll tell you what, full contact MMA Tour de France, that will sell tickets.
I am sure you're right.
Did you ever watch Ben-Hur? Imagine that with like 100 bicycles.
Would there be horses?
No, just bicycles, just, with, okay, you know, spikes on the wheels.
Last Sunday, Manny Pacquiao lost a prize fight, Charlie, unless he didn't. He has called into question the integrity of the referee and the judges, and he says that to prevent the erosion of fan confidence in the integrity of boxing, he must appeal the decision. Did he lose you at some point in that reasoning?
Yeah, the giggle was the giveaway. I sort of admire Manny's ability to get through that sentence without breaking down completely, but it was a terrible decision, and the other guy wasn't a fighter. He was a wrestler, pretty much. Butted Pacquiao twice. The decision is ludicrous. I think what's going to happen is some governing band of thieves or another is going to look at the tape and reduce the decision, but Pacquiao's not going to get the fight.
Wimbledon was invaded on Wednesday, Charlie, and it wasn't gate crashers and it wasn't hooligans the All England club had to worry about. Who or what did the invading?
Flying ants, Bill. Oh, okay. It was a horror show. It's mating season, by the way. I knew that our listeners would want to know when flying ant mating season was so they could, you know,
stay away from Wimbledon.
Stay away from Wimbledon, exactly.
Meanwhile, Bernard Tomic of Australia was fined $15,000 for unsportsmanlike conduct at Wimbledon. This is one of my favorite stories of the week. During his match, Tomic called for a trainer. He acknowledged afterward that he was not injured. He was bored. I've got to wonder what the trainer said when Tomic told him that. Something like, well, son, perhaps you should think about another line of work.
Here, take this amphetamine I brought out. Yes. You'll feel great.
Boredom be gone. Absolutely.
That's right. My favorite one, though, is Medvedev, at the height of his dudgeon against the chair umpire, threw coins at her. This is something McEnroe never did.
A group of recreational league hockey players in Buffalo, New York, has set the record for longest continuous hockey game. 10 days, 10 hours, 3 minutes, and 21 seconds. So, the next time hockey players anywhere complain about having to play in an overtime or two, we can cite this example.
How'd you like to play for 10 days, pal?
Bill, the final score for the final time. Team Blue, 1,723. Team White, 1,695. I think both teams could use new goalies.
It was close.
It was. It was a heart stopper.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Tom Mascheri was known as the Mad Russian during his 10 seasons in the NBA. The 6'6" power forward led the league in personal fouls in 1962, his second season with the then San Francisco Warriors. In 1967, he was selected in the expansion draft by the Supersonics, and he finished his career with 4 seasons in Seattle. But all those numbers from Tom Mascheri's days in the NBA are quite possibly the least interesting things about him. He tells us his story in his own words.
I never felt that poetry was somehow not masculine. My father used to love to recite some of the Russian great epic poems. And my mother was always talking about literature, and she wrote poetry herself. My grandmother was a Tolstoy. They were a very large family, and it included good old War and Peace, Leo Tolstoy. I was born in Harbin, Manchuria. It was the final destination of many white Russians who were escaping the Bolsheviks. My mother arrived there via the Siberian Railroad. My father arrived there via the White Russian Army, being pushed back and back and back by Trotsky's guerrillas, or partisans as they were called. Then they named me Tomislav Nikolaevich Mesheryakov. My mother, because she was working for the American consulate, had wangled a visa for my dad. She convinced him that he should go ahead of us to San Francisco, get a job, and send for us. Unfortunately, as we left, we were actually on the boat, already on the ship, when the war broke out on December 7th, 1941.
A date which will live in infamy.
We were taken by the Japanese to a women and children's camp in Tokyo. And we spent the rest of the war there.
Of the Empire of Japan.
we would look out the window at the bombs dropping and the flak exploding in the air. Oh, it was scary. It was very scary. My mother was terribly frightened. I learned almost every Catholic prayer and Protestant prayer because everybody was praying. We were reunited via the Red Cross. So my father was waiting for us in San Francisco. But I hadn't seen him. I had no idea who he was. You know, my mother showed me one photograph, but he was in a uniform, and he looked extremely handsome, and he was. And I actually went to the wrong person, and I had to be dragged away from somebody I thought was my father, but it wasn't my father. I mean, I remember him hugging me, and he wasn't a very emotional man. And so when I think back on that, that might have been maybe one of two hugs I got from my father in my entire life. So I have to think back on that with good spirit. I hated being a foreigner. My mother sent me off to elementary school the first day in short pants, came home crying because the kids were mean towards me. I had a very thick accent, and I didn't speak English very well. There was a lot of, you know, commie and better dead than red, and I just thought, well, you know, I needed to be an American. So I had been reasonably tortured from the third grade to the sixth grade. I remember, this is a very clear image in my mind, playing kickball, and I was up at the plate, and I kicked the ball, and I kicked the ball so damn far that it went over the fence, the elementary school fence, and out onto Pacific Avenue. That was a good long kick. You know, I ran around the bases and came home, and some of the kids were slapping me on the back, and all of a sudden I realized everything had changed. And it had changed because of athletics. It had changed because I had done something that they respected. And from that point on, I worked very hard to be an athlete. It was 1961, and 1961 was kind of a turning point. All of a sudden, the NBA was starting to become much more substantial, much more of a national entity. When the draft came up, I was drafted number one by the Philadelphia Warriors. You know, my father, I think he was sort of amazed that they would pay a human being to bounce a ball and wear shorts and run up and down the court. He sort of thought it was maybe a little not manly enough. I think he probably would have preferred my being a poet than a basketball player, frankly, because poetry was revered. It was considered very Russian. After my first year with Philadelphia, I was going to be drafted if I didn't join the reserves. So I joined the Army Reserve, and I had to go to basic training, and then I had to go to military school of some sort. So it was a six-month deal. One of the sergeants who knew I played ball came in. I was sleeping, and he nudged me, put a flashlight in my face. He says, "Your team's just been sold to San Francisco." I jumped out of the bunk. I was so elated. Yeah, I went home to San Francisco. We were the San Francisco Warriors. We played in the Cow Palace in the city center to crowds of maybe 3,000 or 4,000. But we were home. I had a temper, I admit, and I wasn't about to back down. And maybe that was sort of the immigrant in me, come to think of it. You know, I had to put up my dukes a lot when I was young. So I think I had a little bit of a short fuse. I was in Seattle, and I'm not even sure if I realized it was Wilt at the time, but somebody hit me with an elbow. And so I went after that person, and it was Wilt. But I wasn't about to back off, so I started swinging. And this is like right out of a comic book. Wilt stretched out his arm, put his palm on my forehead, and as I swung, of course, I couldn't reach him. Here I'm swinging at air, and Wilt is laughing at me, and he's saying, "Come on, Tommy, come on, Tommy." It made me look like a fool, I can tell you that. It's very hard for me sometimes to describe Wilt because he was so much bigger than life and one of the sweetest guys, the most misunderstood guy in the history of basketball. When he finally died, I just couldn't believe it. I just didn't think he'd ever die. I mean, a guy that big, 7 foot, you know, he said he was 7 feet, but he was 7'1". I wrote a poem about Wilt's death, and the poem goes like this. "Morning, Wilt. This morning, I woke up thinking big. Time to crack a dozen eggs, fry all the bacon. I think I'll never shave. Let my beard grow as long as an epic. Dust off those books with thick spines, Gibbon's Rise and Fall, Gone with the Wind, the Summa Theologica. Spend the afternoon with Aquinas's five proofs of God's existence, the uncaused cause, or was it the divine plan that toppled Wilt? It might help reading about the prime mover, but I doubt it. Words are never enough. Let the day end as it began, with a red sun, and let there be a blonde soprano with big bosoms belting out her last aria. We're coming to poetry part of my life?
We are coming to poetry. That is what is happening.
Okay, all right, all right. We're coming to poetry. That actually begins in Seattle as a player. A poet by the name of Mark Strand, who was one of the poet laureates of the United States, came to the University of Washington, and he was part of a poker group that I was playing poker with. And he said, well, if you're really interested in poetry, why don't you come in and sit on my in some of my classes when you're in town, which I did. And it just blew me away. You know, if you're a basketball player and a professional athlete, it's such a rush. Then all of a sudden you're through, and now where does that rush come from? There were a couple of times when I just sat around the house being very depressed. So what actually saved me is poetry. To pick up a little extra cash, I went and worked with poetry in the schools. Through that experience, I realized, hey, I really like working with kids. So I was really working very hard to be the best teacher I could be. Basketball didn't interest me as much. I taught high school English for 24 years. So I actually am more a teacher than I am a basketball player. I retired in 2005, and in 2006, very early on in January, I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. It's a form of blood cancer, white cell blood cancer, incurable. I was frightened. I was very frightened, but there were options, and I went into remission. Then I asked the doctor, well, what's the next step? The doctor said a transplant, a white blood cell transplant. So I had the transplant, and when I was recovering, I had to stay isolated in my house, and so I was there by myself watching NBA. And so I all of a sudden became a fan again. And I've been a fan ever since, and even more so. I'm a fan of the Golden State Warriors, or the Dubs, as they're known. Now, my number has been retired by the Warriors, and it hangs in the rafters along with Wilt's. And it's nice to be there and to feel welcome. I've been in remission now for 10 years, and I've long ago stopped thinking of years, and I think only in terms of months. I like months. I don't like days because that sounds sort of, you know, a little too spiritual. And weeks, it doesn't sound substantial. But months are good, you know. I can do a lot of stuff in a month.
That's teacher, poet, and former NBA player Tom Mascheri. Our story was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given and created in collaboration with Sports Illustrated's Where Are They Now issue, available now at si.com/WATN. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. We had help this week from Mike Moschetto. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Philip Goldberg. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Tom Mascheri, who relates the family legend of what happened when his most famous relative, good old War and Peace Leo Tolstoy, came by to pay his respects to the family.
My great-grandmother kicked his butt out. She was not about to have an atheist in her home.
Oh, that visit must have occurred before the 1870s when Tolstoy experienced a religious conversion and wrote The Death of Ivan Illich. Sports, as Charlie Pierce might say. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. And thanks for listening.